YouTube.com/MaroMediaMedigliani.
In Rolling Stone this past issue. I will tell you that, and I'll say that with peace and love. Recommended highly.
Peace and love.
So interesting. Benji's a good singer. John Oliver has an interesting background. He has a new TV show on HBO, Sunday nights at 11 o'clock. There he is, the famous John Oliver.
In the flesh.
Look at you. I watch it on TV. And there you are in person. Hard to believe.
This is me. Nice to meet you.
Let me see you. That's you, huh?
Nice to meet you. Pleasure to meet all of you.
So much more handsome in real life.
That's, well, it was a low bar, so, yeah.
People say that to me all the time. They go, you're more handsome in real life. I go, oh, I must look so bad on TV.
That's right. How much more handsome? More. Just more.
Just more. John, what a story you have. I can't wait to jump into this with you.
Uh-huh.
Because I have a lot of curiosity about you. I love a rags-to-riches story. You grew up where? In that place called England, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I was basically a borderline pickpocket.
But you were a brilliant student, weren't you? You went to Cambridge University?
Yeah, I was not. I went to Cambridge University, but
right.
I was not a brilliant student. By their standards,
yes.
I was not great.
You were not a great student, but you got into Cambridge, so at some point you must have been a great student, unless you had family connections.
I had the opposite of family connections. I think what it was I went to quite a rough state school, and they had to let a certain amount of people not from basically the Hogwarts of England.
Yes.
And so I slipped in under that.
When you go to Cambridge,
yes.
I would imagine your family is expecting you're going to take on a professional career and have your life spelled out for you. Am I correct?
No, not my family. I think my family was pretty clear that I was not going to be offered much. I was not going to be able to offer much in the way of pride for them in the future.
But you weren't a great student at Cambridge. In fact, you started to do comedy while you were at Cambridge.
I mostly did that. To be honest, that is most of what I did with my time there.
And you joined some sort of comedy troupe while in Cambridge that had elite alumni. It was Sacha Baron Cohen went
there.
Sacha Baron Cohen was at Cambridge? No, but he
was.
He was. And he was part of this comedy troupe, not the same time you were.
No, he was there ahead of me. I think we may have... We may have even gone to the same college in that college.
Was he a legend at that point, Sacha Baron Cohen?
No, not when I was there. He'd done almost nothing. Just as I was about to leave, he was on this show, the 11 o'clock show, and he was just started Ali G then.
Because I bet when he was doing improv back at Cambridge, he must have been brilliant. I would think he must have done some off-the-wall kinds of things.
I'm not sure he did much there.
Wow.
I think he was pretty studious.
Late bloomer, maybe.
I think so. And then, it was because he seemed to come out of basically nowhere. When he first did Ali G, no one could believe what they were watching.
You know, I feel, when I got into radio, I was so bad at it, that as I got better at it, and as I began to emerge, the people I'd worked with in the beginning were like, that fucking guy is making a career for himself?
That's the same rule of stand-up, though, isn't it? It's just relentless failure.
Yes.
You humiliate yourself in front of strangers, and then eventually you have to get better, or you don't.
Or you wither away. And it's crazy.
It's natural selection.
When you first got up and started doing stand-up and improv at Cambridge, were you awful at it?
Of course.
You were.
You can't not be.
And people today don't understand it. They look at the finished product and they go, oh, that guy's gifted. He's got talent. They don't see all of your failures.
They don't see medical school. They don't see no doctor the first time they make an incision. You have a dummy screaming out in pain. You have someone's like, you just killed him again. You just killed him again.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who start out in the business go, oh, I can't be in comedy. I can't be this. I can't be an artist because, oh, I don't have that gift. It's not necessarily a gift.
Although the interesting thing is, with stand-up that I saw some people as I was starting off that were already pretty good, and they then tended to hit a glass ceiling. You need to kind of get crystallized through failure. So a little bit of failure early on is a good thing to knock your edges off.
Was there a point in your life where you went, oh my God, like the light bulb goes on and you go, I get it now. I know what I need to do.
I think there was probably not that I know what I need to do, but there was, I probably had a kind of personal epiphany that I'd learned after a few years. I'd learned to basically make people laugh in the back room of a pub. I knew how to do that, and then that was starting to get quite boring. because I was doing the same kind of thing, and it felt like I was kind of prostituting myself.
You mean you had figured out, hey, I know the formula for going into a pub, yeah, cold, in front of strangers,
exactly,
and making them laugh.
Exactly, strangers who don't necessarily want me to be there.
Right.
I know what to say to make them laugh.
And once you
know how to survive.
And once you survived, once you figured out how to survive, it got boring for you.
Of course, then you learned how to do this. And that's it, then.
So where do you go from there, from the pubs?
Then, so I remember thinking, oh, I'd like to talk about, you know, some more complicated things, or maybe something to do with politics. Maybe I'd like to try and talk about these things. And I did this one gig in Birmingham, and I tried it, and I bombed.
You threw out all your standard material.
I threw it out. I thought, let's see what it's like when I do what I want to do. And it was a crushing failure.
And yet, those kind of failures.
I was so excited.
That excited you,
I hadn't been so happy in years. I was on the bus back home thinking, okay, this is what I want to do.
And you were happy because you said, wait a second, maybe I wasn't that good at it, but at least,
yeah,
I was being authentic.
Exactly.
I was being really me.
Now I need to learn how to do this. And then you can feel your learning curve getting steep, and that's exciting.
And some guys would get crushed by that and say, uh-oh, I got to go back to what I know. I don't want to believe that sticky kind of thing I was doing in the back of the pub.
Yeah, but so that, it must be weird. If you were one of the audience members that night and you watched someone die on his ass in front of you, it must have been very weird to see me walking off stage going, that was fun.
Did your family ever come and see you do those kind of nights?
No.
Say you're
I never wanted them to see me do
right,
stand-up,
you just
ever.
The weird thing for me in radio was my father could hear me on the radio bombing terribly.
I'd always told them I never, ever wanted them to come and see me do stand-up. And I was doing the Edinburgh Festival, this is like 5 years in, and I knew they were in town, and I said, please don't come.
Right.
And I heard my dad about 10 minutes in laugh, and I nearly left.
Wow. What'd your dad do for a living?
He's a teacher. Yeah.
And did they understand this world at all?
Not really.
Didn't you act or something at 8 years old? Like you were in a TV show?
Oh yeah, but that was only because I had black hair and brown eyes. They were literally filming one of those Dickensian dramas.
Yeah.
At a kind of estate down the road, and they just needed an orphan kid.
And do your parents put you up for that?
No, they came to my school and said, what have you got in a black hair, brown eye? That one will do.
And were you shitting your pants? Were you nervous?
No, because I was like 7 years old. I was glad I was getting out of school.
Right.
And they gave me candy.
And so, because that was your first taste of show business, but no one really pushed you into it.
I was done for over 10 years.
After your father shows up to see you at a stand-up gig,
yeah,
do you say to him, Dad, why did you do that to me? I specifically asked you not to come.
No, actually, we did have that conversation, but it ended up being quite a key conversation to have, because he said, oh, people seem to like it. I stood outside afterwards, and you know, I listened to what people said about you, and I said to him, well, you've got a big decision to make here, because how comfortable are you hearing the worst thing in the world said about me? Because one day, soon, possibly tomorrow, that's going to happen.
When you grow up in England, are your comedy heroes British guys, or are they Americans?
Both. Primarily British guys, but then also, you know, I had Richard Pryor, and I love Dennis Miller. But primarily British guys back then, in terms of what...
Do we know any of these people?
Well, probably.
Benny Hill.
No, not Benny Hill.
That's all we know.
You were the only ones who liked him.
I know. British people didn't like... I always heard that British people didn't like Benny Hill.
No, he wasn't that big.
He wasn't that big a deal.
We were going a different way. There was this kind of... I think probably I'm the Benny Hill of now. No one gives a shit who I am in England.
Who were the British comedians that you loved?
I really loved this guy Chris Morris,
right,
and Armando Iannucci. They were doing new stuff when I was a kid, and then Peter Cook,
yeah, he was terrific, and Peter Cook used to team up with Dudley Moore, right?
He did. That was the whole big thing. He did. They had a good partnership.
It's kind of weird if you're a British comedian. It's kind of hard to, if you're just going to be on in England. It's kind of hard to make a living, right? It's weird that we don't know these guys.
Actually, the really strange thing is, it's almost the opposite of that for stand-up. It's much, much easier to make a living in England because everything's so small.
Right.
So it can fundamentally be a meritocracy. And stand-up can be its own reward. You kind of get paid for it wherever you go.
Right.
Even if you're shit at it. So you can basically make, not a dignified living, but a living relatively quickly.
How did you, the way you came to America and made a career for yourself is quite remarkable to me.
Okay.
It was almost like one big accident.
Yeah.
Ricky Gervais was a fan of yours.
I don't know if he was a fan. He knew what I was doing, and they, the Daily Show were looking for a correspondent. They were about to lose two more.
Right.
And so they were looking for someone, and I guess they were going to look slightly further afield than they normally did. And, yeah, apparently he put in a word for me, and then it all happened pretty quickly after
when
that.
When Ricky Gervais said to Jon Stewart himself, hey, you ought to look at this guy.
I think so.
That's what I heard.
I never drilled down into that, so it's one of those things I still, you know, I still don't fully want to know.
You didn't even know what The Daily Show was at that point,
oh, no,
did you?
I very much knew what it was.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah, I very much, I loved it.
And you're living in England, and someone gives you a call and says, hey, Ricky Gervais recommended you, you're hired at The Daily Show?
No, they said, you need to put something up, they want to see you do something, write something. Put it on tape, like in a basement of a London office building.
Right.
Send it over there, and they'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
And so I did it. I wrote something.
What did you write?
I can't remember. It was... I honestly can't remember what it was about, but I remember how quiet the room was. It was just me and a guy who had, like, a camcorder. I remember getting to the end of it, him looking around and going... I mean, do you want to do that again, or was that all right? I guess that's okay.
So what you're indicating is it was an awful tape.
I don't think it was great. I haven't seen it, and I'm guessing it would be rough to watch.
You send over the tape.
Yeah.
How many days before you hear back from them?
Pretty quick.
Wow.
They said, come over here. They want to meet you and do something in the studio. So I came over. I'd never been to America before.
Wow.
So I came over here. Like,
were you scared?
I was kind of more bamboozled than scared, because I still didn't think anything was going to come of it.
Had you appeared on television in England in any serious way? What had you been doing in England?
No, nothing much, just kind of panel shows and nothing.
I see. So Ricky Gervais knew you from these panel shows?
No, I think he knew me from what I had written some stuff for radio.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd worked much more in radio than I had TV.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, and what type of radio stuff were
like
you doing?
Like, radio comedy. BBC Radio 4, still... commissions a lot of original scripted comedy.
And was it political comedy?
Some.
So he hears this, he recommends you, you send the tape is sent, and now they say, come to America.
Come to America.
Young man.
Fievel, come to us.
Yes, find your way to America. And you do it, and you go over, and who do you meet with, the Jon Stewart himself?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of go through it in the studio, and then I go upstairs. And then they say, well, so do you want to come and work here?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's still that point where you think, yeah, I know how this conversation goes. I say yes, and you go, well, dream on, kid.
Get the fuck out of here.
Get back to peasant land. So they said, yeah, do you want to come? I said, yeah. And they went, okay, so how quickly can you be here?
That's remarkable, isn't it?
It was pretty weird.
Have you ever said to John, what did you see in me?
No.
Never did. You don't want analysis of that.
Nope, because you always have that imposter syndrome. You always assume that there was some mistake made that you never want uncovered.
Isn't the toughest part of that when they suddenly say, come work, and now you're faced with, I've got to somehow integrate myself into this organism
yeah.
that it's already structured,
yeah.
everybody knows everyone, and you're the new guy, and you walk in and you're like, what? You got to find your place.
Yeah.
And were you hired as an on-air correspondent or as a writer at first?
I was hired as an on-air correspondent, and then I became a writer soon after.
Was there resistance at first to putting you in anything? Were people like, oh, fuck this guy? I mean,
No. Strangely, I don't know if this was designed or an accident, but so I went back, I packed a bag,
yeah.
came here. I kind of landed Sunday night, and then something had happened between Tony Blair and George Bush at some summit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the previous day, so I then had to write and do something on the show that night. So it all happened really quick.
Did you recognize this as your big break? Is this like, wow,
no,
this is a wow moment?
Well, I mean, it was a wow moment, but in terms of big break, my manager in England said to me, don't sign a lease any longer than 3 weeks, because they'll fire you. That's what they do in America.
That's what they do. So they do.
So that's why I brought one bag.
But Jon Stewart, I feel, is a little bit different of a guy. He's sort of a loyal guy.
Yeah,
he'll give you a chance to grow.
Yeah,
right?
I don't think he's the classic American model. But yeah, he will invest in you and teach you how to do what you're supposed to already know.
He's a good human being.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he really is. I have a good feeling about Jon.
Yeah, he's... Right, because he is objectively incredibly talented.
Right.
He's amazingly smart. But underneath that, he really is an amazing guy.
When you're there and you're watching him do his thing, it's sort of like an apprenticeship in a sense. You're learning the whole time you're there. That's your real college.
The whole time.
The Daily Show.
The thing I learned the most. It's the place I learned the most.
And at some point, even when you're working on The Daily Show, NBC came to you and offered you a full-time job on the TV show Community, didn't they?
They offered me a pilot, and I had no real interest in doing a pilot.
But it's funny. Why not? I mean, because I loved
The Daily Show.
You loved The Daily Show.
Yeah.
That's like your place, The Daily Show, where you feel most comfortable.
Yeah.
So leaving The Daily Show...
That was not going to happen. So I managed to work out with them saying, oh, if it gets picked up, and again, I didn't even realize then that there was almost no chance of it getting picked up.
Right.
If it got picked up, then I would just come as a guest star, not a guest star stretching the town star.
And Community.
Guest star. Right. A star that no one has heard of.
So you would appear on Community from time to time.
Yeah.
But you did in no way wanted to be a regular on that show.
No, because I didn't want to leave The Daily Show.
I bet there was a lot more money in being on Community, a bigger payday, than being on The Daily Show, for sure.
Oh, I would have thought so.
So your integrity walking away from the Community gig...
You never want to find out how much...
You didn't find out? You didn't say to them?
That's not a conversation you... No, I think I said to my manager, I don't want to... Let's just say... No, let's have this discussion before the pilot of, I don't want to do this. I never wanted to get in the situation of having to turn down, so you're going to turn down this amount of money?
Because it could really fuck your head up as a performer. I mean, you don't turn, you know, it's the odds of making that kind of money are very, very slim.
Right, there's being authentic to yourself, and there's being a financial idiot.
He seems to have this history of never... trying to find out what's going on.
Yeah, that's right.
Perfect.
Live in ignorance.
Live in the dark.
Yeah.
Now, when you decide to go to America and do this, certainly you. Who is the first person you call to tell the good news that you've gotten a gig in America on The Daily Show?
It was my manager.
I
called him to say, yeah, I need to move my stuff here. And then it was my best friend. I said, I need to pack up my...
Who is your best friend?
Daniel Kitson. Yeah, he's a stand-up in England.
He's still your best friend?
At this point in your life, too, you're not... I know you're married now, but at that point, you're not even involved with a lot of women or anything. You're focused on your career, right?
Howard, is this the face of a man who's been involved with a lot of women at any point in his life?
I'm with you at the same point, you know. I know that face. I have the same one.
That's right. We wear the same face.
So, in a way, isn't that a saving grace? Isn't that a saving grace, in a sense, because you're completely focused on your career?
I think so. Yeah. I think it was probably all the way through school. I was able to focus on things other than women. Women made that clear.
Was that a tremendous disappointment in your life that women... I mean, here you are. You're a very intelligent guy, and you're a funny guy. And you know how women always say, I want a funny, intelligent man. I don't care about looks. Mm-hmm. It's all horseshit, right?
Is that true? No, it's not true.
It's certainly not true at high school.
Were you angry with women for not rejection, not noticing?
I think I could see their point of view.
agreed with that.
Yeah, because if you look at the people that they're attracted to, the people that can throw things far and kick things accurately and whose face is symmetrical, you've got to look and go, yeah, you're right.
Right.
That's obviously.
I can't throw a thing and my face is not symmetrical.
I can't throw it.
Wouldn't it be great to be in a bizarre universe where throwing things wasn't what women were attracted to.
That doesn't make sense. What you just said makes no fucking sense to me.
But didn't that anger you, being this intelligent guy? I mean, and you're a guy who matured and you had sexual parts. Weren't you just angry at these women for not...
I don't know if it ever got to anger.
Right.
I think it was more a kind of probably a regular sadness.
an overwhelming sadness.
An overwhelming persistent sadness.
Did it take you a long time to lose your virginity, or was there some woman out there who took pity on you?
I think it was basically that. It was someone going, listen, I get what's happened here.
I'll fuck you.
That's right.
Right.
When did that happen? How old were you?
I think I was about 17, 18.
That ain't
really?
Bad. That's not bad. And you had the odds against you, and yet you managed to score.
That was late.
And you didn't have to pay anyone?
I didn't have, there was no transaction.
No transaction.
No transaction was made. One may have been expected.
You just bought a hot cocoa. That was it.
That's what I said. This is priceless.
That's probably your greatest accomplishment, I think.
Yeah, in terms of really beating the odds,
So you weren't a ladies' man. Did the ladies start to recognize you on The Daily Show when you started to be on TV? Was that when you started to get your sexual confidence?
The ladies?
Nebulous. The ladies.
This sexual confidence that you refer to
makes
no sense to me.
Even in marriage.
Again, I'm a comedian with this face, Howard.
Yeah.
If I had confidence, it would be misplaced.
What's amazing to me is the background of your wife, and I would think you'd have to be married to someone somewhat intellectual, and your wife is almost as amazing as you are.
She's much more amazing than I am.
She's American.
What she's done with her life, she's American, yeah.
And when 9/11 occurred,
yeah,
what was she at that point, in college?
She had just left high school.
She had just left high school.
Yeah.
Intelligent woman, got into a good college, I believe, right?
I
wasn't
think
she?
So.
Yeah. And she decided, fuck that, I'm joining the military. I want to fight for my country.
Yeah, she joined the army after September the 11th. Yeah.
Tough woman.
Yeah. So she was a combat medic, and she was in Iraq from 2003 to 2005.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, a dynamic woman. And I think a woman would have to be somewhat dynamic to get you to marry her, right? I mean, true?
I guess, again, I'm not sure the power was in my favor there.
Do you think you're incredibly mature that now that you have this fame and money coming in, your own show, you could have been banging a lot of hot chicks, and it could have been every guy's fantasy to do
I think
this.
It's probably safer for that to remain a hypothetical.
Right.
In my mind, then, that's still possible. Oh, yeah, of course. The option was, I'm banging my way up and down the West Coast.
Right.
Even though I think we all know that probably was not on the cards.
Your wife.
How does he meet this fabulous woman?
Yeah, where do you meet this fabulous woman?
I actually met her. I was shooting for The Daily Show at the conventions in 2008.
Uh-huh.
Right. Oh,
and,
yeah.
Exactly. And so she was at the RNC. And she was at the DNC and the RNC, but I ran into her at the RNC because I was about to get arrested.
Why were you about to get arrested? What was the bit you were doing?
We were shooting somewhere we weren't, but not, it was a three-tier thing in St. Paul, Minneapolis, that arena, and we weren't allowed on the middle tier, and that's where all the people that we wanted to interview were. So we would, each day, the caterers liked us, so we would put the cameras through with their catering equipment, like with one of those cake trolleys.
By the way, does that make you just nervous in the pit of your stomach when you have to go do a bit like that where you're not wanted at the Republican National Convention?
Yeah.
They see you as subversive. They they probably have you on a list somewhere.
The first time, it was nervous.
Yeah.
But by that point, by 2008, I was dead inside.
you were a dead individual.
Me. You can't hurt me. There's nothing left to hurt.
But when you're planning to get into somewhere where you're really not supposed to be, I mean, it is uncomfortable, right?
It's uncomfortable, but it's also fun. Like, there's like the six-year-old version of you going, oh, you're doing something naughty. It's just, this time you're doing something naughty. With armed guards wanting
right.
you not to do it. It's not quite, you know, breaking someone's window.
So they were about to arrest you because you were trying to sneak in and they caught you?
We had sneaked in,
mm-hmm.
and they realized we didn't have the passes to shoot there, so we were getting chased by security. But I couldn't get arrested then, because
right.
I was on a visa. And if you get arrested on a visa,
you're out of the country.
You're gone. So I was right, and then they hid us, my wife and
you were like Anne Frank, and she was...
that's not an overstatement.
Right.
That is an entirely fair
she
comparison.
She hid you from the Nazis.
She did.
Yeah, and that's why you fell in love with her.
That's right.
Yeah.
She built me a library case.
She hid you in the attic, so to speak.
That's right. I took my shoes off, and I padded around.
Did you start a diary?
From that day, I did. She was my Peter.
You bring up a good point. Because you are a British citizen, at the time.
Yeah.
When you were with The Daily Show and the writer's strike occurred in this country, you decided, hey, I'm a writer, I'm going to go out on strike. But going out on strike was a bigger risk for you. Because
it was a huge risk. I was striking against my visa.
That's right. If you go on, explain this to me. If you go on strike and you're a visitor from England and you're here on a working visa.
I can't remember what it was. I just remember there being trouble. I remember talking to my immigration lawyer at the time and I'm saying, yeah, you got yourself a bit of a sticky situation here.
I'm going on strike, and supposedly if you go on strike, you could be deported?
I think that is one of the potential outcomes to it. Yeah, because,
no kidding.
Because you're striking against the people that control your visa, who were at that point of HICOM. So.
Right, and you're supposedly here and you're here for a working visa, and since they're sort of sponsoring you...
Yeah, you don't really have those kind of workers' rights.
Viacom could have said to you, I'm reporting you for going out on strike.
I think they could. I'm glad they didn't.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty nerve-wracking.
It was the awful, awful time.
And taking a risk at the Republican National Convention could have landed you in the same hot water.
It could have. Yeah, it could have. You just have to try and keep your head down. You just have to be the first one to run away. And I'm naturally coward-like.
Did you encounter any of that where people go, hey, fuck you, man, you're from England. What are you being all subversive? Go back to your own country and be subversive.
Sure.
You did?
Sure, yeah. That was, yeah. Unfortunately, what you want is to encounter that on camera, not off camera.
That's the hard part about a guy with an English accent trying to make it in this country, especially with a political bent. You know, because you comment on our country, and you're from England, and people start to get defensive and say, it's one thing if we joke about it.
Yeah.
It's another thing if you do.
I think Yeah, I understand that. I think it's kind of, I see it visually as my country now as well.
Right.
British people often see other people's countries as their countries. That's been a problem throughout history. but no, I love it here, and yeah, I've married an American. I see this as my home, even if my career blows up in a bad way.
Right.
I think I would love to stay here in America. So yeah, I feel a kind of emotional investment.
I read some funny story, not funny, but when you got your own HBO show, which we're going to talk about in a minute, you called your wife to tell her, hey, honey, I got my own show.
I couldn't call her.
Well, where was she?
She was in the Philippines.
And what was she doing?
She was that typhoon.
Right.
She was doing triage. She was doing.
She went over there to help.
Yeah, she was.
Wow.
She went
so
there
you
with.
You couldn't call her and tell her your good news because she's there.
I couldn't. There was no infrastructure. Everything had gone.
And if you had told your own silly good news that you had your own show.
Well, I couldn't. That was the problem. There was a satellite phone they managed to get at once. She was with this group, Team Rubicon, with these veterans who go to disaster zones. Yeah, I got this kind of crackly satellite phone call from her, and she's talking about just how hellish, like, just Armageddon-like hellish the situation is over there. And there was no window in that conversation to pivot to, well, here's some good news.
Guess what, honey?
Guess what?
This woman sounds like a saint.
She's pretty amazing.
Is she a medic? What is she?
She's a combat medic. Yeah.
Whoa, so she's a medical doctor.
Yeah. So it's basically for what the army were teaching them then was to go into it's basically trauma. It's basically trauma medicine. So
wow.
It's going to wherever the worst things are happening.
What a dynamic woman.
Yeah. It doesn't quite make sense to me.
That she loves you.
That's every day.
And it's good being married to a woman like that because you're so busy in your life that she obviously has a very full life.
What does she do when she's just at home?
Well, now she's having to retrain because it's a ridiculous situation where no qualifications like that from the U.S. Army transfer into civilian life.
Uh-huh.
So now she's having to retrain to become... Wow. What she'd like to do is work in an ER, I think.
I see.
Do trauma there.
Now let's talk about this gig. You get on The Daily Show, and you're obviously good at it. And at some point, Jon Stewart decides to go direct his movie.
Yeah.
You know, this movie. God knows what this movie... Have you seen this movie
yet? I haven't seen it yet. I've seen bits.
I mean, it sounds like the second coming of Christ, this movie, right? He has to go do this movie.
Yeah.
And so you get the shot at hosting The Daily Show. And I remember watching, and I thought, wow, this guy's really good.
Did you?
I did. I really did. No. I was like, wow, he's really a natural at it. You didn't seem nervous at all stepping into John's shoes.
That is not the case. I remember that first show, when the music started, I remember my heart was beating so hard. There was you know how you can have full thoughts in split seconds? I remember thinking as the camera came in, is it possible to visually see under a shirt a heart pounding? Because that is not going to look good.
Did John, did you have any idea that John saw you as his replacement go-to guy? I mean, was it a shock to you? Does John come to you and say, look, I have this burning passion to direct some Fakakta movie.
Can he use that as a pull quote?
Sure, absolutely. Does he come to you and say, I want you to fill in for me?
I knew he was writing a movie for a while. He was writing this for a while.
Right.
And then he called me one weekend and said, I've got this, it looks like the movie's going to get made, and they're going to let me direct it. At this point, I was just thinking, oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Thanks for sharing your
news. What a lovely phone call.
Right, I'll have to call my wife.
And then he said, which means I'm going to be gone for 3 months, and stand in for me.
Now, how do you play the answer? Do you go right away? Yeah.
I just said whatever. I just said yeah, whatever you want. I'll do whatever you want me to do.
Do you ever say to him, "Gee, I'm afraid. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. I don't know if I'll be able to fill in."
That was the next day.
Right.
I literally said to him I said on the phone, "Yeah, that of course, whatever you want. I'll do whatever you want, whenever you want."
And you had serious doubts. Like the next day, you woke up and said, "Well, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe."
Well, I put the phone down, and then I said, "My wife said what's wrong." So that was not a great sign.
Right.
She's looking at my face.
Well, as a medic, she saw you were losing blood. Right.
We got
trauma.
Exactly.
So you wake up the next day and you're like, oh my God, I'm going to fill in for Jon Stewart. I mean, the loyalty to that show.
Yeah.
I would imagine is the biggest fear, oh my God, I'll lose the ratings?
my biggest fear was letting him down, and so that was part of it. But I didn't want if he was putting this amazing level of trust in me to do, you know, to be, take care of this show that is very important to both of us. You know, his this is his amazing thing that he's built.
But don't you think there's the neurotic part of me would have gone, maybe he's picking me because he thinks I'm the weakest person to do it, and then everyone will miss me.
Oh my God, that never occurred. No, that is such a, I'm so fucking glad we did not meet beforehand.
You don't want to know me.
Oh my God, this is the worst thing would have been to come on here just before we went, do you ever, good luck on Monday for start. In the back of your mind that this is probably going to be a disaster.
So you looked at it like, wow, he's placing the franchise in my hands, I could really screw up the Daily Show. And the amazing thing about the Daily Show is that as a late night show, I think most people would have predicted when it started that it wouldn't have much of an impact. And yet what it's done is it finally reinvented the late night program. We always see the Johnny Carson model. We see Letterman, we see Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, they all do that. But Jon Stewart went off and did something particularly brilliant. He came up with something fresh and new. And so this is his baby, in a sense, and he's handing it off to you.
It's unique. And I think he knows, as well as I do, that what he's built there is solid enough and it's resilient enough that I probably couldn't destroy it. I could destroy it in 3 months to the point that there was no show when he got back.
Yeah, but
there was something he could. The people there are talented enough that they could carry me to an extent. It's just it could have been.
But your delivery and the way you do deliver the content of the Daily Show, it really does rest on your shoulders. I mean, you really did carry the thing off beautifully.
Well, because the only way that show works is that John does everything.
And let's face it, once you filled in.
Yeah.
Suddenly, there was like, hey, who is this guy? Because he's a genuine, legitimate host. The ratings remained high, right? Did they go up a little bit even?
No. But they went down not too much. That was the triumph.
That was the trick.
That was the triumph. They
went
down.
Your great triumph was that it didn't go too high.
They were not catastrophically down. And when you set a bar that low, then...
Now, are you the kind of guy, when you do replace Jon Stewart, did you sit there and go, let me check the ratings. I better check every day. Did you get a ratings sort of update?
Yeah, I didn't really know fully what they meant. I just wanted to know whether I was getting everyone in trouble.
Right. Were the executives making you very aware? Do they come down and say,
we're protected from all of them.
That's good. Thank God, because that can make you crazy. Does John check in with you while he's off directing?
Yeah.
He does.
He was amazing.
And what does he do? He says, hey, you're doing a great job, or does he say, I suggest you do this? Can he be critical of you?
No, he was pretty much, especially for the first few weeks when the filming schedule was down there, he was really available for me to just ask questions to him.
And once you're in that anchor seat, and once you're hosting the show, you don't want to give that up. I mean, let's face it, the thought of John coming back is great, and you love John, and he gave you a break. But at the same point, wow, this is a pretty great gig, and I can do it. I can master this.
Actually, that's not true. I really.
But isn't it the same guy who's in the pub going in the back going, I've already mastered being in the pub. I've already mastered being on The Daily Show. Now I want to master being the host of The Daily Show.
Yeah, but that's. But I think I was so. I'd set him coming back as in my mind as the end of my job in terms of what he was asking me to do.
Right.
Like I thought, if I can just give him his show back in one piece.
And you did.
Then I can kind of tie a ribbon around that hosting experience and think, okay, because that's his show. Any success I had on that week is kind of down to him.
Well, what's great about your success is, you know, I love when hard work is rewarded because after all the years of you being a stand-up and doing improv and then coming over to this country after all of this, you go on, and it's like a Broadway show, like you were discovered overnight, because suddenly now everyone's coming at you with offers.
Right.
And you know, I'm shocked by this. I think Comedy Central, when they realized they had a gold mine in you, that perhaps you could have been a new franchise for them, they should have locked you up contractually. I imagine, again, I'm not there, but if I'm Jon Stewart, I'm pissed off at Comedy Central. I'm pissed off because I've developed this guy. I've brought him into the Comedy Central fold. John Oliver hits the ball out of the park. And now I got to lose the fucking guy to HBO. And I think John would be pissed.
I don't know. I mean, there was no space. There was no space. Comedy Central had no space. They had shows at 11, 11:30, and 12, so...
There yeah, but they can lock you up and offer you something at 10 o'clock. What's the right. difference?
I don't know.
Did they come to you at all?
It never came to that.
They never came to that.
It never came to that. They couldn't compete with what HBO were offering in terms of, like, this is your own show, this is how we can back it.
There was discussion that out of this this period of time when John gave it to you, John even himself knew that he might lose you because he knew you were that good and that this would showcase your talent.
No, he was amazing. He was absolutely incredible. Like, this is, he could see what was happening long before I could. So he said, before he left, he said, look, when I get back, we'll talk about what you should do next, because this is going to, you know, you're not going to be able to go back to what your old job. And that felt horrifying to me, because all I wanted at that point was to go back to my old job and for everything to be the same.
At what point does HBO come to? Because the other big offer I heard, the other sort of rumor was, and I think it was more than a rumor, I think it was confirmed, that CBS was considering replacing Craig Ferguson with you.
That was not, yeah. They were considering their options. It never came to, I never got an offer for that.
You never had a discussion with them?
No, I never went that far. That I did. I spoke with Les Moonves just as a kind of, hey, how you doing? The summer was very nice. Thank you, Les. It's nice to meet you.
Les called you or he came and met with you?
I met with him.
You went to his office?
Yeah.
The office with the bedroom in it?
Yeah.
What?
No.
He didn't take you into the bedroom?
That just goes to show there was no offer. I never made it to the bedroom.
Off to the side of his office is a bedroom. I go, hey, Les, what is this exactly? And then I jumped under the covers and he made passionate love to me.
I can't close a deal, Howard.
Les, in other words, Les came to you. It's such a great story because here you hosted the Daily Show, you filled in, and you slammed it out of the park. Suddenly you get a call from Les Moonves. This is an important guy in the company, uh-huh. in the business. And Les really said, I guess, was feeling you out for maybe a late night slot.
Maybe, I don't know.
He never brought it up.
No, he kind of brought it up in the sense that every conversation that you've always had with people, oh, what would you like to do next? I don't know.
But can you say specifically, what about replacing one of our late night shows?
No, it never went that far.
He never said to you, Letterman is leaving.
No.
Craig Ferguson is probably going to leave.
No.
Never.
Never. Never. No, he never got to that.
So why do you think he brought you up there?
I don't know.
He wants to meet with creative people and find out what they're talking.
Maybe. I appreciated it. I thought he was a phenomenal human being. He's almost a cartoon character. In my head, he is what I see someone in his job behaving like. It's like, he doesn't have a cigar permanently in his mouth, but it's like you can almost see it.
Do you laugh at guys like that because they are so stereotypical?
Oh, he's awesome. I loved him.
You loved him. Yeah, well, listen, he was paying you a compliment. He has you up there.
Yeah, but also, it was just a pleasure to see someone in that role go, hey, kid.
Yeah.
Nice job, kid.
Does he wine and dine you at all? Does he offer you a lunch? Nothing.
I think I was offered a coffee, didn't take it, took the water, but the water was already there. It might have been from the previous interview.
How long a conversation was it?
Oh, not long.
Not long at all. Yeah. But HBO is a different conversation. They pick up the phone and go, hey, we have something in mind for you.
So they said, what about doing a show on Sunday night once a week? And that made me think, uh-oh.
This could be trouble.
That seemed like amazing. So I talked to John and he said, yeah, you'd be insane to turn that down.
You went and told John.
Yeah,
I still believe that John is upset that he doesn't have you in the fold. Now, not only do you go to HBO, and it's a sweetheart deal in the sense that now you can do it once a week. Instead of having to knock out material every day, you can write material all week and prepare, and then HBO shows the show over and over again.
Yeah.
I think that's preferable to what they have to do on The Daily Show.
It's not that way yet. At the moment, it's kind of screwing with my head just because, you know, you second guess everything. You know, like, you're doing it every day, there's a mental clarity to that because you kind of, there's a system in place for you to prepare something, write something, perform it, not think too much about it.
But
there's momentum.
Let me harp on this for a second. How could John be thrilled with this if not only did you go to HBO, but you brought the head writer from The Daily Show over?
Yeah, he came with me.
That's John's head writer.
Yeah, but he'd been there for a long time, and he was looking for something else to do.
You don't think John's angry about that, that he lost his head writer?
I don't think so. Did you call John and say,
I want to take the head writer too?
We talked about it the whole way through.
And he was okay with that?
Yeah, he is an amazing man.
much more amazing than anybody I know. Honestly, I would have cut your head off with a sword.
I don't doubt that. Your eyes rolled back in your head when you were picturing that.
Let's test how good a guy John is. How about you take his wife next? Just and his kids. I mean,
is she looking for something else to do?
Yeah. I mean, just keep seeing what else you can take from John.
Yeah, again, this face is not a bargaining chip to be a wife stealer.
But so John's okay. The head writer's over at your new show. Yeah. And he's cool with all of this.
He's been great, yeah. I've been in contact with him most weeks.
And when you get to HBO,
yeah,
are you overwhelmed with responsibility right away? Like, this is awesome. You've got this whole show resting on your shoulders. Are you pretty calm about this?
No, I'm pretty overwhelmed because I've got a taste. I have no experience of management of any kind.
You're the boss.
Yeah, and so I got a little version of it when I sat in for John, but that's still just trying to keep this amazing machine that he's built perfectly running.
Right. You're not really the boss, John's.
You're really not.
Right.
Yeah, and you can tell, even though I'm technically sitting in for him completely and that, you know, I have the final say, you know full well, people are quite rightly thinking, he's back in September, we'll talk again then.
Well, you're right, being the boss is a whole different thing, you know.
Yeah,
like when
the
I think
real
about
boss.
Jimmy Fallon, who took over the Tonight Show, has Lorne Michaels sort of running things, which is nice. You don't really have, do you have an executive running things
for
you?
No, it's just Tim and I and Liz Danton, we run it together.
You're the guys and girls who run this thing. And how many staff members do you have?
Oh, I don't know. We're not at a final number yet. I don't even know how many we have in total.
And what is the budget on a show like that? Is it a tremendous budget in hiring writers and crews?
It took a few months.
So you're running $1 million.
To even find a studio took a long time.
It's a millions and millions of dollars budget.
Yeah, because every studio. I was just saying before, every studio in New York has a fucking kitchen in the middle of it. There was this one studio when we were in real trouble. We went to see Rachel Ray's studio,
right.
And this guy showed me around saying, "This could be a perfect thing. You know, you can put your desk over here." And I said, "Does that oven move?" And he said, "No, because it's a thing, but you could use it." I'm not doing a baking segment.
If the show tanks, you could stick your head in the oven. That's it. It'll be a perfect segment.
It would be an amazingly ballsy situational joke just to have a full working kitchen and never use it.
Why is it so hard to find a studio in Manhattan?
I think it's just, I don't know. I think if it's real estate or just there's so many cooking shows here, Chopped.
Where did you eventually find a studio?
57th.
57th Street is where you do it.
Yeah.
Is there a live audience?
Yeah.
There is a live audience.
Yeah, they're just usually silent.
But you've got to have a live audience, right? You want that feedback.
Yeah.
What do you do when they're silent? When something tanks, can you then edit out the bit afterwards?
No, because I'm again from John Stewart's model of we kind of basically keep in most mistakes. Unless it's a catastrophic mistake.
Because it makes you feel like there's more at risk.
Yeah, and it's basically, and it just feels more like if you flub something a little bit and you recover, then just...
Now, HBO is getting more and more political with their humor. I mean, they got Bill Maher. Have you met Bill Maher?
No, I never met him. He's West Coast.
West Coast guy.
Yeah,
there's no camaraderie. It's not like, hey, we all work for HBO. Let's all get together and have a big party.
No.
There's no sort of version of upfronts where you all get together and hang out.
No, there's nothing.
Are you a fan of his show?
I've watched it. I don't watch it all the time.
So you're not really a fan?
No, I like him. I like it. I like him.
He's okay, but he's not somebody you would tune into.
If I'm going to watch something on TV, it's not going to be more political comedy.
Right.
It's
going to
be sports or Project Runway.
Well, is there, exactly, is there, or Bachelorette, is there a
no,
fear?
No, I can't do it. I can't.
Oh,
it's
you don't know
sad.
What you're missing.
It's too sad.
But isn't there the theory, too, as a comedian, if you watch a political show, like, let's say, Bill Maher or somebody, that you could unconsciously or subconsciously take that material, and you don't want to even be accused of
it? Yeah, I do check it. I do. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You don't want it, or you don't even want it to spark a thought that you could then trace back to there. So you've got to be very careful. That's exactly it. You want to make sure that you're mentally clean.
Because comedians always accuse each other of stealing material.
Of course, of course.
And you just don't want that.
Comedians standing back at the back room of stand-up clubs going, I was doing that 3 years ago, and you probably saw it.
Yeah, you saw me
in Arkansas.
Yeah, you took my bit.
You took my chicken joke.
That's right.
That's my chicken bit. I'm famous for my chicken bit.
This is so it's an amazing story, and you say the money is way better than what they were paying you at the Daily Show.
It's not just the money. It's the fact that I could. It was. I could offer. I could build something from scratch because as you know, I was a custodian of John's machine,
right?
And that's why this was much more challenging because I was kind of that was a womb for me. You know, I was nurtured nonstop.
What's the process like? How much time are you putting in on this? I envision you being busier than ever, right?
I mean, much, much worse hours.
What's the schedule like? What time you wake up in the morning?
Like 7, and then I'm there from like 9 till 8 every day.
What goes on? Are you scouring the newspaper all the time? I imagine you have to be well-versed. I mean, to be a political comedian and to do political bits and do political satire, you've got to be versed on everything that is going on. And you have to have an opinion on everything that
goes on. Well, you have to be able to fake it well enough. That's for sure.
But I'm
still working out how to do this. We've only done 10 shows. We haven't really done anything.
How many shows do you have to do a season?
I think we've got to do 24 this year.
24 shows.
Yeah.
And people go, oh, what's the big deal, 24? But that's a lot of shows, really.
You could put yourself through hell. Yeah.
Yeah. Because how much stuff do you reject? I mean, you probably write and write.
Yeah, a lot. And it's a real 30 minutes. It's not like a commercial TV 30 minutes.
Right.
And there's a lot of, like, you want to use the fact you have this weak run up, and so then put in produced elements or put in more research to it. So the process is changing non-stop, so I still don't know what the best form of making this show is, because I'm having to unlearn some of the amazing lessons of the daily grind.
Do bits get edited out because a week has gone by and then suddenly nobody cares about it? It gets too old?
Not really, because we at the moment, and again, it's only 10 shows, but at the moment we've actually kind of moved away from those kind of stories, the ones that get picked over the week.
Yeah.
So we haven't lost anything like that.
Because you're always trying to find the fresh angle and something new. And so who is the guy who makes the final decision as to whether a bit gets on the show or not? Is it you?
It's me.
That's it?
It's on me.
The buck stops here kind of thing.
Full buck stopper. Yeah. That's
wow.
me. So,
but do people get angry with you when their bits don't get in? Do they ever come to you and say you're making the wrong move here?
I don't... if they do, I hope they phrase it like that. Listen, you're making the wrong move here.
Yeah. You're fucking everything up. Get out.
I can do that myself. I don't need someone to tell me that. But no, they're not so far. No, but it's again, there's no stable process yet. We don't really have a consistent way to make the show.
So from 7 in the morning till 9 at night, pretty much you're there. Does your wife say to you, look, where are you at in this marriage? You're never home. Or does she give you the space?
No, she gives me the space, but also she has exactly as much respect for what I do as you would think from someone who's been in a war zone.
Yeah, she thinks it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
She's like, why did you man up and join the army?
I think my muscle mass answers that question for her.
Right.
But, yeah, there's a certain level of complaints that you can give her about, oh, it was stressful, we can't get this bit to work, before you can see something in her eyes going, why don't you shut the fuck up permanently?
But what about, you guys don't have any kids, right?
No, we haven't.
There's no room for kids in this relationship right now. I mean, you're both too busy.
Right? Wow. You sound like the opposite of my mother.
but does your mother say that to you? Because you're
too busy,
you work too hard?
No, she says she wants grandkids.
No.
Are you a workaholic?
Yeah.
You are.
Think so.
Is there any time for you to hit the gym? I mean, I don't see any evidence of it, but then again, is there any time for you to have a life of your own? I mean, on the weekend, do you turn off the email and say, hey, I'm going to spend time?
I try.
But it's hard.
It's hard, because I was this way at the Daily Show. That show was my life.
I picture you on the weekend, sitting there.
Yeah, go on.
With the newspaper, I gotta find that. Oh my God, what is this? What did Obama say? What is this guy? You know, Harry Reid.
No, I'm feverishly working. I'm in a weight room, Howard. I'm lifting. It's non-stop.
Do you have hobbies?
Arm day, leg day, arm day.
Do you have hobbies?
Do I have hobbies? I like sport. I like watching sport. The World Cup was amazing.
You like the World Cup?
Yeah.
Well,
no, I don't like it. I love it.
You love it?
Yeah.
I have no understanding of it.
Really?
I mean, to me, it might as well be badminton. I don't understand it.
I love it so much.
Yeah.
Because you look forward to it. I'm now looking forward to the next one. I have a 4-year period to get excited about that.
Do you play soccer? Do you ever go yeah. out and you kick a ball around?
I'll kick a ball.
You have a bunch of mates who you, that's what you're called mates in England. Do you have a bunch of mates that you get together and
yeah,
you
we
kick
used to
a ball?
Play, we used to play every Tuesday. Me and my bunch of mates.
Your mates?
Me and my mates yeah. would kick. All right, mate. Thanks, mate.
Are you good at it? I mean, can you bounce the ball on your head and use your feet?
I've got basic motor skills.
Doesn't it drive you crazy that you can't use your hands at all?
That never occurs to me.
Never, I mean, it's ridiculous. I would just pick up the ball and throw it at somebody. I would throw it in that stupid goal.
I would love some player at the World Cup suddenly to pick the ball up and go, hold on, guys, this is ridiculous. What we're doing is ridiculous.
It's absurd. So that's it. Other than that, you're working all the time. And yeah. you get up 7 in the morning. Do you make your own breakfast at home?
No, I have it at work. Sometimes.
You have it at work,
yeah.
And you get right in the office, yeah. and everyone, what, does everyone pile into your office and they start, or do you sit there alone like Nixon, and you grumble to yourself and wait for them to come into the office with bits?
I sit there alone like Nixon, yeah. basically making racial epithets.
The Jews.
That's right.
And the Negroes.
I rant about Jews, hoping that tape recorder that is on my desk for no reason
Where's Rabbi Baruch Korps?
What are we going to do about these Jews?
So what do you and then they come to you with all these bits. And what is the big story right now that you're working on for the next show?
Today. So this is day one, because our weekend is Monday, Tuesday.
Okay.
So we'll work that out now.
I see. And then
this
you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this sounds exciting as hell. I'm excited for you.
Thanks. The show
is called Last Week Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
John Oliver is the star. So it's Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
That's right.
How hard is it to come up with a name for a new show? Did it come to you quickly?
No, it was hard.
What are some of the horrible names you came up with?
God, there were some really bad ones. It was the first time I was never in a band, so it's my first time in my life that I was kind of... You know, when you hear a band saying, we were going to call ourselves, you know, the Sonic Explosion.
Right.
Or Power Deuce.
Or Massive Diarrhea.
Exactly.
There's always a bunch of bad names.
Exactly. I honestly can't remember.
And they were
bad. I have a document somewhere. Of course they were bad.
And you want it to be a great name, because you realize this could be your brand for years and years.
Well, you've got to live with it. This is something... If this is a pile of shit, you're going to be sitting on this pile of shit.
And did you ever think of just calling it the John Oliver Show? There was no option there, right?
It feels slightly misleading, because it's not like a...
Had you called it pile of shit, I would have loved it.
A pile of shit with John Oliver.
Yeah.
That's right, he's going to be his own worst critic straight away.
But Last Week Tonight was your name that you came up with?
I think it might have been, yeah.
Right. It doesn't work that way. You all
sit
around.
No star. We almost had no staff at that point. It was just me, Tim, and Liz.
And you have to go to HBO and say, this is what I'm going to call the show?
Yeah, but then they just don't...
They don't care. They got you and they're happy.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to know with them whether it's kind of this amazing, giving people as much... as creative freedom as they can, or whether they just don't care.
Isn't it
either
nice,
way, it's great.
Isn't it nice how America accepted you? I mean, when you look at, let's say, Piers Morgan, who came over, he had a hard time with his CNN show. America did not, accept him in droves.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at that at all? Are you a friend of Piers? I assume all you guys know each other.
I would question whether Britain has really accepted him in droves.
Is he not a big deal over in England?
He's a big deal.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a big deal. That's for sure.
You don't like Piers Morgan?
I'm not one of his most tenacious fans.
Right.
No.
Why is that? Because of, the wiretapping accusations? I guess he was proven innocent. I mean...
Sure.
Yeah. But you don't like his attitude?
Let's just say he's not been proven guilty yet.
Right. But you just don't... He rubs you the wrong way.
Yeah. He was an editor of a rough tabloid newspaper. He's not the most...
You're not a fan of that.
I'm not a fan of that particular... kind of journalism.
Who are the people that you regularly look at when you're deciding what to cover for the week?
Yeah.
Who are the people you look at in America and you go, why the fuck are we, who are these people and why are people like being worshipped? Is it the Kardashians that you get upset about?
I don't even care.
You don't care, right?
I don't care.
You don't really care about any of that.
I don't care about it.
What do you care about right now?
What bothers me more is what is not covered on actual cable news programs.
Like,
the first show, the first week, our first ever show, I couldn't believe there was no coverage of the Indian election. We did a whole, our first show, our main thing was about the Indian election, which was the biggest exercise in democracy in human history.
You're talking about India?
India.
The country.
850 million voters. It's the biggest ever. There's never been a bigger election.
You're saying
you can see it anywhere.
850 million people actually voted.
Voters.
And that's a big story in itself because no one votes
democracy
anymore.
Democracy has never been bigger. They were building polling stations. There was a law about how far every person had to be from a polling station, or how close they had to be, not the opposite of here, where how far they're supposed to be, how close they're supposed to be. So they were building polling stations like, at the side of mountains because there was like a tiny village needed access.
You went to the writers' meeting that week and
we said we have to go, and we were looking up because we use this Snapstream. Which is this way of, it's like LexisNexis but with video. So you kind of, we were looking up how much coverage there'd been in the last 3 months on this, and there's nothing.
And your angle on that was, I can't believe Americans aren't amazed by the Indian election.
No, I think Americans would be amazed by it.
But
I can't believe that it's not being covered. I can't believe people either think so little of American people or so little of Indians that they think this just wouldn't
Do you watch Fox News and cable news and MSNBC?
I used to watch it a lot when I was at The Daily Show. Now, less so.
Why?
I used to watch it all the time.
You don't spend as much time picking on Fox News? Because John likes to pick on Fox News, right?
Well, it's more that we're not in that, like you were saying earlier on, we're not in that daily cycle.
Right.
So you don't want to get caught up in something that you can't compete with.
Right.
So instead, I tend to not watch too much of that now.
So when you have a topic as dry as the Indian election, how do you find humor in the Indian election?
Because it's amazing, because the way they covered it is incredible. Their news over there is absolutely fucking insane.
In India?
Yeah, they have like 12 boxes of them screaming at each other. They imported it all.
How many candidates are there?
There's absolutely hundreds, but it came down to two.
It came down to two, just like every other country.
Yeah, it came down to this guy Gandhi and Narendra Modi, who was a very controversial figure.
And I got to figure in India, if your name's Gandhi, you got
a little leg up.
Yeah,
you got a huge edge. That's a political dynasty.
I would change my name to Gandhi.
Yeah.
You know, if I was running over there. And why would you want to run
Gandhi,
India?
Gandhi, you have to give it to me.
And who would want to run India? It seems like a terrible, terrible job.
Well, the thing is, there are a massive emerging. So you could do something spectacular there, but you're right. That seems too difficult for most rational human beings.
What was the big issue in Indian elections? Like, what did you?
Genuinely, the big issue is sanitation. It was kind of run on toilets, not temples. Yeah,
they're
shitting in the streets.
I know, and shitting in their water.
Yep.
Did Gandhi win?
No, Gandhi lost.
You're kidding.
It was a huge political upset. Gandhi lost to this guy Narendra Modi, who used to sell tea on a railway station. You know, this is a poor kid. That kind of upward mobility is not supposed to exist in India.
Right.
We, the British, helped them with a rigorous class system that you're not supposed to be able to escape.
Well, isn't it amazing? Wouldn't you want a guy who rose from the dredges? Because to get rid of the waste in India, you need a can-do guy,
you've
right?
You've got to know where the waste is. You've got to have had your ankles
you've
in that
waste. You've got to have had your nose in it.
Exactly.
Yes.
You know where this guy Gandhi made a mistake?
Mm-hmm.
He should have named himself Gandhi. Gandhi. Two Gandhi.
Double Gandhi.
Gandhi squared to the fourth power.
You cannot turn down double Gandhi. That would be incredible. It's just like, listen, India, I'm calling myself Gandhi. It's double Gandhi. There's no election. You're obviously voting for this.
So this is why people like you, because you identify for them the issues or the stories that we don't necessarily get in the media.
You don't get in the media, but you care about it.
You
innately care about it now because it's interesting.
Well, you're making it interesting.
Well,
you know you are. I mean, and God knows what this new guy's going to do about sanitation. Did you find yourself rooting for the guy who won, or did you root for
Gandhi?
Well,
it's very difficult though, see, because you always want to root for an underdog. But right. Narendra Modi was a governor of this area, Gujarat, and he presided over a massacre of a lot of Muslims.
Oh,
so he didn't. So there was a lot of controversy there.
A guy who supervised
and
the massacre of Muslims, and then
supervised is a little bit of a stretch. It could be that way.
Right.
He certainly watched that massacre happen and didn't seem to be running in slow motion towards it, telling them to stop.
So it sounds to me like you didn't like this guy.
No, he was very interesting, but Yeah, I mean, it's...
You still have to question that.
He needs to turn down his Islamophobia a little bit.
When you were this weekend thinking about what you're going to bring to your writing session this week, you probably have a little... Do you have a little folder of topics? Do you work on a computer?
Notes.
Little notes. What is the thing besides the Indian election now that you're really focused on? What are you really fantasizing? You haven't come up with a thing yet. You haven't figured it out yet, but you're really focused on it.
We won't do this week, but there's something very interesting to me about the fact that an American hedge fund managed to stop an Argentine warship from leaving a port.
How'd they do that?
Because this Argentina owes them money, this hedge fund, from buying their debts back when the economy collapsed in 2002. They want 100 cents on the dollar. So this sovereign nation's Argentine warship was in a port in Ghana, and this hedge fund of, 100 rich American douches managed to stop it from moving.
So your point is, this is what's really behind your comedy, the corporations are more powerful than the countries themselves.
Well, in this situation,
yes,
this isn't even a corporation. This is 100 guys in Manhattan.
Right.
This is a hedge fund. They're so fascinating to me, and we're not going to be able to do it this week because I don't fundamentally understand how it works.
You need to really understand this before you comment on it.
Yeah, because you can't tear it apart.
But that thing about that, exactly, that thing about, it's like
so
the
you have people research this whole situation?
Yeah,
you're interested enough.
Yeah, because it felt like that's like the monster appearing over the water just for a second. You go, wow, how much power do you people have? And then it's gone again.
This is what's great about you. You pick out these stories that everyone else is ignoring, and you would have been a great journalist. You really are a journalist, don't you think?
Well, because I've said fuck too much.
No, but being an investigative journalist means having a natural curiosity about the things.
Well, yeah, I've probably got that, but there are lots of people have that.
Where do you get that story? Where did you find it? Do you find that in the New York Times?
I can't remember where I saw that.
But wherever you saw it, it clicked with you.
Well, yeah, just because it's a little glimpse. It's a little glimpse of, it's like a small version of something that's fascinating. It's just like the fact that, look, we did this piece last year on The Daily Show about gun control, but we did it around this small thing that happened in Australia.
Right.
Because Australia had it.
Yes.
And so we went there, and that's like a very, very narrow example to do something much broader.
So it sounds to me like you're leading up to finding out who these douchebags are that were able to stop an Argentine warship. That's where you're headed.
I
don't understand how it works. I don't think anyone does.
How you stop a warship?
I also, hedge funds. I don't understand what they do. I can't get my head around. And the more I look at it, the less it makes sense.
Yeah, I wish you could. See, this is why I like you. You could explain to me what a hedge fund is.
Not right now, I can't.
You will figure it out for me.
We're going to try and figure it out.
And you will let me know how these guys make this massive amount of money.
I don't know how it works.
But there's got to be something wrong with it. You can't make that much money that quickly.
It's money beyond imagining. It's money and nothing. I don't know what happens to the money. It's like a card trick.
Yes.
All of a sudden, well, here's your money. I've taken your money. Where's your money? Look at your money. Look at your money. Look at your money. Here's the money. Where's your money? Is that the left? That's not your money. That's not your money anymore. That's this guy's money.
And when you ask someone to explain it to you, and you're a smart guy. You went to Cambridge. You get this convoluted answer.
I fundamentally do not understand it. And just when you think that's when you know it's complicated. Just when you think you've understood it, like, you'll think, oh yeah, I think I'll get it. Look away for a second, and the whole thing is gone.
You know, and you're so right. Like, I mean, here we are. We grow up in a country where, you know, we have airplanes, but most of us don't know how airplanes work. We couldn't build one. We have no concept, and we accept it. We see a new phone. We don't know how that phone really works.
Right.
We just buy it, and we accept it. But hedge funds, you know, there isn't a day that goes by in the newspaper you read about some guy just became a multi-billionaire with a hedge fund, bought a house in the Hamptons and an airplane. But yet, none of us seem to know, except for a few.
No.
How you do it.
Right, and also there's no investment in any broader consequences. That's the problem. So, like, if Argentina defaults, like a bank, an international bank, would think, well, Argentina can't default because, you know, that will affect this thing that we're not going to affect, and in the broader sense, we will suffer from that. 100 guys in a hedge fund would think, if you default, I don't give a shit if you default, fucking Argentina, I'll go to Brazil instead. I don't, this is no consequence. We give me my money.
And does the hedge fund now own the warship even?
No, they don't. No, they don't. They, no. That, that, they just
they
delay it.
But they don't want to own anything.
Delay it.
Yeah.
The fact they could delay a warship.
Yeah, my chances are I'll tune into your new show at some point, and you will not only explain this to me, you will teach me what a hedge fund is in some funny way.
And but it's more. That's the problem. It's even more common because technically, under their deal, they're right. Technically, they're right. Technically, Argentina does owe them that money. It's just everyone else is settling for a deal, a cent on the dollar, and this hedge fund, they're negotiating now, but they're holding out for, we want 100 cents on the dollar.
You, in a sense, have to spoon-feed us news. Not only do you have to find an interesting topic, you have to make it funny.
Yeah, I don't know if we can even do this, though, because it's so hard.
Because it's complicated.
Yeah, and you do want to understand, you want to get it right.
Right.
And it's that Omar thing in The Wire. If you cover the king, you best not miss. If you cover the hedge fund,
right,
you had better be sure you're right.
Are you ever afraid for your life? Now, I mean, maybe that sounds crazy, but there are certain topics, like, if you go after the Ku Klux Klan and you try to do a piece on them, there could be real consequences. I remember there was a radio host who was very, very political, and he got assassinated. I don't know who did it ultimately. Or if you try to take on the mafia, or if you try
to... Or even these hedge funds. They're stopping warships.
Seriously, do you ever worry, do you ever back off a story because you say, hey, no?
No. What's the point? You can't live in fear.
You wouldn't do a story, let's say, on one of these gangs in L.A., right?
Yeah, of course.
You would?
Yeah, why not?
Because you could get killed.
Probably. But probably not. That's the truth. You could get killed anywhere. And also, I think there's a responsibility. You know that guy, do you know Bassem Youssef? He's the
That's comedian. Cat Stevens, isn't it?
No. Close. Yeah,
Bassem Youssef is.
You're 50% there.
Yeah, go ahead, Bassem.
He's this guy in Egypt. He's a comedian in Egypt. And he set up a version, kind of like a Daily Show over there. And he's an amazing guy. But that's gradually, occasionally taken off air. At the moment, it's off air for good.
Right.
He actually has real consequences.
That's right.
So he has to, I'm lucky, I live in America.
Are you under
I'm
the illusion?
From so many consequences.
But are you under the illusion that those kinds of things can't happen in this country?
I know they can happen.
They can happen.
Yeah, but so can, I could get hit by a cab.
But do you ever say to yourself, this story is so complicated, I just don't, I'm exhausted from it. I can't do the story on Argentina and the hedge fund and this and that because it's so fucking complicated.
Yeah, because you want to get it right, but then we can move it back. We can just say, maybe we'll do it, maybe it won't be on the Argentina, maybe we'll do this thing in a few weeks or a few months.
Do you ever worry that you're tackling a story that just nobody cares about except for you? Do you sit there and kind of try to do a focus group and figure out what people are interested
really,
in?
If it's interesting enough to dive into, you have to assume that there's something there.
There's probably no greater satisfaction than teaching the American public about the election in India. In a sense, even though you're doing, there's probably some great satisfaction.
But it's not even because people are inherently interested in this stuff. There's more satisfaction in exposing the fact that people were wrong to assume they wouldn't be interested.
So we're lucky we have you, because you are giving us information. That's what you're here to say. That America is very lucky.
He's basically pointing out that the networks and cable are underestimating the American public.
And that's why I think younger generations are turning to programs like yours for their information.
For some of their information. They don't.
Do you think that's all hype? Do you think...
Bullshit. It's how you phrase the question. If you say, do you get your news from The Daily Show or cable news?
Right.
Young people will go, I don't watch cable news, I watch The Daily Show.
But I'll talk to my kids. They'll watch it. They don't even use the TV. They watch on the computer.
Exactly. So they get it from, 100 different resources online. It's just that question no longer applies to young people.
So you don't feel like you're more important than the news, but you do have to admit that the news, especially the network news, has become way less relevant. It really has. It's taken a back seat to...
There's some good stuff. Frontline is still amazing. They're still doing some amazing things. There's still good stuff out there. It's not all a clown car.
You were nominated for Emmys with The Daily Show.
With The Daily Show, for writing,
Right. But it's too early in this show to be nominated for an Emmy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we're not nominated.
Let me tell you, there's a lot going on here.
less than you think.
Your life is very complicated.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's see. Go to work, go home, go to sleep.
It's such a complex life.
Listen, it's your show and this is your life.
Go to work, go home, apologize for being late, go to sleep.
Yeah. Congratulations. And tell your wife I am a big admirer of her.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that.
She really sounds incredible.
She's something else. Yeah, she is humblingly amazing.
And when are we going to have a baby? That's always the next step. When are we talking about?
Soon, Howard. I'll see what I can do.
Are you using contraception at this point, or are you just, like, seeing what happens?
Here's the problem, Howard.
Go ahead.
Just on the off chance that any member of our family listens to this,
go ahead.
Let's punt on the contraception question.
Really? Wow. Well, now we've hit into something.
Oh, really?
Is your radar gone?
Are you pulling out and just hoping for the best?
Holy shit.
Exactly. Exactly. Forget India for a second. Gandhi over there. Let's find out what's going on at home.
That's it. See, that's your version of India, isn't it?
I believe you and your wife are trying to have a baby.
No, we're not having. We're not trying yet, but we would like to.
Okay,
yeah,
very good. All right, that's good. And we'll find out on the next interview where your warship is docked.
Where the warship is docked, and also where we are in terms of contraception.
The TV show is called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
Yeah.
I was excited to meet you.
Me too.
I've met you, and I've gotten a lot out of you, and I've learned about you. And now I'm satisfied. My hunger is filled.
You know, you know as well as I do that hunger is never filled.
The hunger is never filled.
You cannot fill that hole.
It's a nasty beast, that hole.
We're cut from the same cloth.
It's
why
so
work
true.
This hole?
You can't fill that hole.
You can't do it.
That dark hole.
Uh-uh.
Listen, the show was Sunday night at 11 o'clock on HBO, and then
yeah.
they re-aired it a couple of times.
Yeah.
Must have been. How long was the negotiation on in terms of the salary and the contract? That's a complicated thing to work out, isn't
it? Not long.
Really?
Wasn't long. Yeah, because there was more. I don't really have a huge amount of leverage.
But did you take their first money offer, or did you just kind of say, no, I need a little more?
You say, no, a little more.
A little more. And then they came through.
And then they came through. But really, the thing I really wanted was that. Was the Sunday night thing. Because it was intriguing to me because there's no other shows on then.
Sunday night's the good night.
Sunday night, and it's because it felt like you could potentially could do something a bit different there. Because you're not on anyone's toes. No, there's no show like it has been on.
And then you become like the 60 Minutes of HBO. You know what I mean? Like it's your thing.
What, the thing people fall asleep in front of?
Exactly. That's what you want. You want those eyeballs sleeping. And the ratings don't know that.
They don't change the channel.
It doesn't matter. You do not need to be awake. I cannot stress that enough. There's no need for you to be able to absorb the information I'm giving.
And the next time you see Les Moonves, make him show you the bedroom. And his.
Oh, guarantee you, I will absolutely do that.
You must do that. And I congratulate you on this show and your quick rise to fame.
Overnight.
That's right. That'll teach Jon Stewart to go make dopey movies. Now look what he unleashed.
For Cactus.
That's right. Do you make fun of you make fun of guys like Rush Limbaugh and no, you don't.
There's no point.
There's no point.
No.
What do you mean there's no point?
He's a troll. There's no point in giving the oxygen that he craves.
You don't like a guy. Isn't it odd when you see people who have one sort of political leaning? Like, it seems to me you should have different sort of views.
Of course.
Views, right?
If you're a rational human being.
Right. You can't possibly agree with
everything.
Any kind
of polarization is incredibly irritating.
Are you into religion at all?
No, not really.
I get the feeling that you're an atheist.
I'm not an atheist, no. I'm not an atheist.
You have
religion. I'm not a thing. Either.
You're not, you don't go to
services. I don't have
services.
Any. I got nothing. I got nothing, Howard.
Who is your hero beside me?
You. Drop off.
Yes.
Especially after that double Gandhi comment.
Who is your hero?
Who's my hero?
Who is the one person you would love to get on your show and
honestly, the practical hero I have, and it might make you scared to hear it, is probably John.
John Stewart?
Yeah, because he's been everything to me.
All right, if you want to go with that answer, go with it.
He's, and in terms of a practical day-to-day sense, in terms of like an abstract hero in comedy, Richard Pryor's probably the
Richard
best stand-up who's ever lived.
Eddie Murphy was better than Richard Pryor.
That is not true.
No, it is true.
It's obviously it's hard to... say that this is an objective conversation, but you are absolutely wrong about that.
Thank you.
We'll argue about this some other time. All right, listen. Mm-hmm. You've said a lot. I think you've said enough.
This is exactly how I wanted it to end, Howard. Listen, you've said a lot.
You've said a lot and you've said enough.
Yeah.
But honestly, it was a pleasure meeting you.
No, you too, Howard. I'm a big fan of yours.
And I'm a big fan of yours as well, so it's a mutual suck-up.
Okay.
And and there's a hedge fund outside waiting to arrest you and send you back to your native country.
Right,
are you an American citizen now?
No, I've got a green card.
A green card?
I'm married an American.
Ah, we're safe.
So we should be okay.
Believe me, I think you are. Don't miss Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, Sunday nights at 11 o'clock.
Well, what does he do at election time?
On
does
HBO.
He go to
I don't
England?
Love taxation without representation.
Right, and taxes you are paying. I would think the hardest part of your HBO contract was getting a budget. Like, you had to negotiate also the budget for your show. That's probably more of a
yes.
concern than your own salary.
That is what I actually meant. That it was the stuff around the show which was more difficult because, this is a more expensive way of making this kind of television than perhaps you might objectively think it needs to be.
Right, because you have
the staff, researchers, there's a lot of stuff you got
to
have.
You wanted to make sure you could bring over your executive producer at a good salary and all
but
of
but
that.
It's also like in terms of, again, like you need more researchers than might seem make sense to the outside world.
And HBO wrote the check, right? They didn't give you any hassle.
They don't care.
They don't care. That's what we learned. HBO
doesn't
care.
That's their new slogan.
And it is the most intriguing, the most life-affirming slogan is, listen, don't worry about it. We don't
Do you
care.
Have a network liaison that comes down and at least looks in on
they
things?
They don't care.
They don't care.
In the best way.
Isn't that wonderful?
They don't care. It's either incredible artistic freedom or they're just not watching.
Either they're incompetent, lazy.
Either they've managed to fail upwards.
Right.
HBO. Yeah, amazing.
We don't care.
We don't care.
All right, don't miss Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, Sunday nights on the network that doesn't care. HBO.
That's right.
At 11 o'clock. All right, thank you, John.
Thank you, Howard.
Right, we'll be back right after these words.
YouTube.com/